still point in a turning world. And it comes from a poem, part of a poem by T.S. Eliot. And he says, at the still point of the turning world, neither from nor towards, at the still point there is the dance. Neither arrest, neither stopping, nor movement. And it's not called fixity, it's not frozen. Where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor going down, just the point, the still point. And I quote it because we usually don't feel that. We feel that life is kind of out of control, disturbing, stressful, running, busy, always needed, always doing, always full, a bit like, you know, Auger in a wheel, hamster going around a wheel. And the social world, the world in which we live, seems non-stop disturbing. I looked at the front page of Haaretz newspaper this morning, and it was an amazing, amazing picture of a totally hysterical, angry, wild man, Egyptian, in the middle of the all the what's going on there, and behind him it looked like the whole city was burning. And there was a really strong picture of out of control, like who is benefiting from all, you know, where is the benefit? It's sort of a sense that so often the social world is just disturbing us and making us go against something very deep, which is what is nutritious, what is helping. And there's endless conflict and endless friction between people and in the world and so on. And even in our own inner life, we stop here together, and we can stop for a while, then the body gets restless. So the body begins to disturb us. Or we stop for a while and the mind begins to disturb us. So how long do we have, kazeh, hafsaka, before neither the body nor the mind nor the environment nor the people talking in the flat to us, how long do we have before we are disturbed? It may not be very long. So it's not, we can't blame anyone else really. So we could try and help a little bit externally. And that's what we're doing here. We turn off our mobile phones, we get a bit simple, we turn off the TV, we reduce the stimulation and the input. But the noise keeps going. There is noise. It's noisy. Noisy to be a human being. It's just noisy. And never mind if we turn off the mobile phone. There's a mobile phone going here anyway. And partly the noise inside is we're busy shutting off the noise inside. And when we actually stop for a while and stay and quieten down and look inside, it often is a little bit like a pool of water. When the waves are stopping, we actually see all the mud that's around. So we actually see more when we stop, when we don't escape into diversion and into busyness and into the mobile phones. We actually see more. And when we see more, again, we feel noise and disturbance and so on. And a lot of it is the fact that we keep needing to process the world. Ibud, to process. We feel compelled to process everything going on. So if there's a noise in the neighbors, we can't see it as just sound. We need to relate to it, to think about it, to feel, that's what's disturbing my, I came for a retreat and that's disturbing me. Or the heat, I came for a retreat and that's disturbing me. Or the noise in the mind, I came here to be quiet and that's disturbing me. So we kind of, the processing of the world brings disturbance. And in a way the sound is just sound. That's all it is. It's waves in the air that touch our ears. So it's just sound. So for us to say it's disturbing me is us. Really, we are disturbing the sound. The sound's not disturbing us. Because we make out of it a story called disturbance. There isn't any disturbance anywhere. Where is disturbance? Sound is just sound. There's no such thing as disturbance. We disturb the sound. We disturb ourselves. And it happens in chains, in Sharsharot. And we studied this. We spent a year in Tel Aviv and also here in the north studying exactly how this happens in a bit more fine detail in the teaching of Paticca Samuppada, or the dependent arising, how things arise in our consciousness based on something coming in through the senses, and how we build from their stories, and how we build resistance, and how we build liking, not liking, and what that creates, a kind of self, me not liking, and how the self is involved in all this. It's a very rich teaching, and I can't go into it at the moment. But just to say that there is something about the process of interpreting the world by the self that has a world there and a self here that is by definition disturbing. The fact that that's happening is enough to disturb us. It is enough to, in a way, steal some deep, deep, deep peace and stillness and quiet. That the still point in the turning world that T.S. Eliot is talking about is almost unfindable if we are interpreting the world out there that needs to be survive. We need to survive and get on and eat and live and be healthy, and the world inside, a self that needs to cope and manage and so on. That definition from the beginning is the source of disturbance. And because of that, one of the most famous talks of the Buddha, which in the Buddhist tradition is the talk where 1,000 people were instantly awakened. And it's like a huge event that seems to have happened, maybe. We don't know if anything happened then. But let's say, mythologically, it was a huge event that 1,000 people heard him and were enlightened. Woke up. And the event was the fire sermon. And the fire sermon started where someone said to him, I'm worshipping fire, like the Hindu, in the Hindu faith. And he said, you are burning. We are burning. Human beings are burning. And what are we burning with? We're burning with the senses. And the senses, not just senses that just have sound coming in. The senses are related to. So it's, I need, I want, I have to have. I interpret. the world is like this, we need this, I need this, I'm not still. Everything coming in through the senses has a message, makes a wave, makes a disturbance, makes a response, and that's fire. We're burning up through all the time, tguvatiyut, reactivity, neediness, wanting, not wanting, liking, not liking, coping, not coping, managing, this, arguing, fighting. So that's burning. And it's really interesting, I just this morning had an association that one time in the Weizmann Institute, they put me in an MRI scan, brain scan, to do an experiment on meditation inside the MRI machine. So they asked me to meditate inside the machine, and it was an experiment with that the Weizmann Institute were doing on meditators. And they also asked me to do all kinds of mental calculations, like counting backwards and counting forwards and so on, and meditating. And then we saw the pictures later. And it's really interesting that the pictures show, in a way, yellow color, even in when the mind is quiet, it's actually burning. The MRI machine shows yellow when the mind is active. And it's yellow heat, it's heat, it measures sort of heat, it measures oxygen, which is kind of fire. So actually this yellow color on the pictures of, and even meditators who were meditating in there showed yellow color patches of you, much, much less. And what was not fire in the mind was blue color. And at a certain point they took a picture of my mind, my own mind, and I was delighted. Here was proof. There was no yellow color at all. It was a totally blue brain with no yellow. It's like my brain has no fire at a certain point when I was in that machine. But just to show, our mind is burning. It isn't just that the world is disturbing us. We are disturbing the world. We are busy in our mind. And the image of Nibbana, the translation of the word Nibbana is cooling, is to cool the fire. That's the translation of the word. Nibbana means cooling down. And it doesn't mean anesthesia, kind of hardama klali. It doesn't mean shutting down the system. It doesn't mean not acting, or not doing, or not being, or not thinking. It doesn't mean any of that. Because clearly the Buddha he gave 10,000 talks. For the Buddha to give 10,000 talks, he had to think a lot, and use a lot of language. And I was talking this morning about Krishnamurti, and I will quote him in a minute. But he is an awakened teacher, and he taught, like in 50 years, 2 million, there's a disc, 2 million words. He was trying to teach the teachings of stillness, using 2 million words in his life. So clearly it's not about not doing, it's not about being dead, it's not about not living. It's something else. Nirvana is cooling down in another way. And in the Indian mythology, when you put out a fire, it doesn't vanish. It simply returns to the universe. It's a nice way of looking at it. That is, fire, as one of the four elements, is inherent in the universe. So is earth, so is water. It's part of the nature of things. But when you collect fire together and put wood and strike a match and make a bonfire, you've gathered fire together, and it's very intense and burning and hot. And so the image of Nibbana is not stopping, cooling down, it's the fire going back into the universe. It means something about returning home to the universe. And there is where awakening is. There is where the real peace is in the returning, the reabsorbing ourselves into the world, rather than this struggle called living and disturbance. It basically, there's no me. If there's no me to defend, then there's nothing that can be a problem. There's no problem anymore. Disturbance comes because there's a me that is trying to defend itself against disturbance. Disturbance is anything and everything. So it comes from some basic need to protect me and the separation from me and the world. And the Nirvana tells us that there's a kind of reabsorption into the world. Hitmazgut, we call it, to absorb ourselves back into the world, and there is real total peace and awakening, because the world and us are one thing. And it's exactly what we were doing this morning. In a small way, all the instruction you got this morning was about that, of just returning to a place of absorption into the moment, the foot touching the ground. That's it. It's very simple. It seems too simple, but that's it. Foot touching the ground is being absorbed back into the world. Instead of me, what I have to do, and I only, when I walk, I think of what I need to buy in the shop, and where I'm going, and if I'm running, I need to run away or run towards, or I need to tap my watch to know that I'm doing exercise. No, it's reabsorbing into the world. No, the world without boundaries, the world, as Tibetan text says, the world is looking out of your eyes. Not me looking at the world, it's the world looking at the world. The body looking at the body. It's a different way. And there is genuine peace, a genuine, genuine peace, which cannot be disturbed, because there's no person there that is needs to struggle and protect himself, herself. And it's not forcing quiet. It's not pushing for quiet. It's not fixing noise. It's not stopping disturbance. It's not trying to fix anything or trying to kind of repair anything. It's not giving medicines in it. We say, oh, I really want to stop. But that's fine. It's okay to want to stop, but it's still a sort of fixing. Something needs to be fixed. Nevertheless, so how do we go about this? It is true that calming the external, does help us. And I mentioned it this morning. So we come to Kliel to be reminded of nature, a bit of quiet, the turning off the mobile phones. This is external, this is fine. It's a kind of reminder, and it's at least a good beginning. And in the main instruction of Satipatthana Sutta, which is the main Buddhist text for the mindfulness, the Vipassana tradition, the first thing the Buddha said is, sit down under a tree or in an abandoned building and give up hunger for the world. Just before you even start to meditate, just reduce the hunger that we have for the world. And then bring your attention here to the breath and body. And so the first step is that sense of, yes, a little bit we do need, it's helpful for us to go on a retreat. It's not that the retreat will bring us nirvana, it's that the retreat is a very good condition, initial condition for this, beginning condition. And then we slow down a bit. And we do turn off the mobile phones, and we do not watch TV, and we do stop. And the process begins of samadhi. And samadhi is translated sometimes as concentration. But really the translation of samadhi is to gather ourselves, to collect ourselves together. So instead of this pizur, this scattering and chaos inside which makes us out of control and everything in life disturbs us, we gather ourselves, collect ourselves together in this spot. And this is what we did. We were sitting 45 minutes, sitting half an hour. It's gathering ourselves together. And it's that place, it's very helpful. It's a very helpful place to not by force, but by presence, we meet our inner peace. But then things do come up, like I said before, when we see the still pool, the mud, we see the mud underneath, and it's there. And so we reduce the external disturbance and we find internal disturbance. But that's where the Vipassana practice begins, and that's where it's important to understand it. We are not trying to be censorship. We're not trying to, for the sake of peace, cut out by surgery, nituach, disturbing thoughts. Because all that it does is create more conflict. It can be any thought, that unpleasant thought that comes round and round and round, but it doesn't help us to fight the unpleasant thoughts. It doesn't help us to wish them to go away, to struggle against them, to fight them, to get angry about ourselves. It helps us to see that the mud at the bottom of the pool is okay. It's all right. It's us. It's the conditioning. It's the stuff we've collected on the way of life. It's okay. There's mud at the bottom of the pool, and there's also the clear water. And the two are together. So instead of saying, I want the clear water and I have to get rid of the mud, if you try and get rid of the mud, you just have more mud. The mud is disturbed, you can't see the water. No. Clear water, and there's the mud. It's fine. It's okay. But we need to see that this is there, and it arises and passes like everything else. It doesn't really belong to us. There is mud. Okay? There is a leg. There is a touch of the ground. And there is a bit of mud. Okay? That's the nature of things. There was a couple of retreats ago, where someone said, I have to talk to you. And I got a petek. You get lots of them teaching retreats. And some of the takim and meetings are so good. Not all of them are problems that need to be solved, like the mud. Please help me with my mud. Some of them are really wonderful little notes. So this was one of them, the wonderful little notes. And a young guy came and said, I suddenly realized I'm all the time, and I've done several retreats, and all the time I have these voices in my mind and I'm trying to fix them. And the voice is the voice of self-criticism, that I'm no good in some way. And I'm all the time trying to fix these voices and trying to deal with the voices and trying to calm them down and trying to do walking meditation, do breathing meditation, and the voices keep coming up. And all of a sudden, in this retreat, I deeply understood that nothing needs to be fixed. There is nothing that needs to be fixed. And it was such a beautiful insight. It's just an insight. It wasn't rational. It wasn't a kind of a sort of, it wasn't in the sechel, it wasn't in the thinking mind at all. It was a knowing that was deeper than the thinking mind that says, there is nothing that needs fixing here. Nothing needs to be fixed. Very clear, deep knowing, insight, tovana. When we ask what it is that disturbs us, the classic Buddhist understanding would be its attachments. And I just want to give you the list of attachments to give you an idea of what it is we're talking about when we talk about attachments, or talk about those attachments are hitsamduyot, those things that we feel stuck that disturb us because we are stuck with something. There are attachments to the senses, exactly what I was talking about before. Noise is a sense. So attachment to the noise is attachment to what the noise brings us as a chain of paticca-samuppada, chain of conditioning. Noise disturbing me, I can't meditate because there's cars outside. That's attachment to the senses, processing the senses and giving it a negative or a positive, I like, I don't like, it's good for me, it's not good for me, I have to deal with it, I have to get rid of it, I have to take it, I have to reject it, I have to push it away, I have to collect, you know, all the world of senses, attachment to anything coming into the senses, which is processed and has in it liking, not liking, etc., is one group of attachment. Another group would be views, opinions, decisions about the world. I believe, I think, what I think about the world is like that, the world is not like that, because of course that produces the, you know, an opposite. Someone will say, yes, it is like that, it's not like that, I believe it, I don't believe. Anything, basically anything that we think is a fact, uvda, is actually a disturbance. That's very radical. I won't get into it now. It's very radical. In a dynamic, changing world, facts don't really exist. So our attachment to the world like this, or the world like that, or I see the world like that, or I need the world to be like that, or I don't want the world to be like that, is all the views and beliefs and so on. That's another source of disturbance. A third source of disturbance is forms. That's why the Buddha said, in the end, give up the Dharma. It's all a rapsoda, a raft. When you don't need it anymore, let it go. Let forms go. A retreat is a form. After a while, you need to let it go. The word practice, you even need to let that go, because it implies a form. I have to practice for my liberation is a conclusion, a form. Let it go. So a third form of attachment is anything to do with behaviors, rituals also, social behaviors, the mind of the herd, the edder, you know, all kinds of things to do with what's right, what people tell us is right, what parents tell us is right or wrong. And the fourth is the self, of course, and that's all our boundaries and defenses and our belief that we exist here and we have to protect ourselves and respond to life all the time. Tugvatiyut, haganatiyut, and so on. So there's attachments, and attachments bring us isheket, non-quiet. And therefore, if we want to actually really see the quietness and experience the quietness, the stillness, the still point in the turning world, the world is turning, but the still point in the turning world, we really need to move towards a place where things don't belong to us anymore, that we're not the center of things. Things pass by, things are dynamic, the sound comes and goes, we don't need to respond, we don't need to attack it, we don't need to be disturbed by it. It's a sound that comes and goes by itself, And we are here, still point in the turning world. There's a beautiful image from the Tibetan tradition called the Dakini. And Dakini is the world, actually. It's everything that happens. Every single thing that happens in the world, a thought, a chemical reaction, a bird flying by. And the images of a Dakini is of a female goddess, little one, the size of a molecule, that is all the time turning and dancing. And it's like almost like Tibetan version of molecular physics. Everything that happens is a Ela Katana, a little goddess, an angel, that's turning and making the world happen, and she's female. And I just like the image, but it's kind of an image that, you know, yeah, everything is turning, and there's little angels that are turning and making the world happen, but they don't need to disturb me. They're just there. I'm also part of it. They're doing it inside me. My thoughts are little angels turning around and turning and turning. It's fine. It's a different image that is not me in the middle trying to cope with the world and do things in the world and defend myself. So in the practice, called practice, we're really all we need to do, we don't need to be too heavy with our practice. We just need to drop into a place of relaxed witnessing the way things move and change, on and on and on. And it does take time, and it may take months or years, and it is very real, very effective, and very powerful in just reducing the attachments that disturb us. Just this sense of relaxed awareness. The things are happening and dancing around us. The thoughts are coming up and they're dancing. The sound is coming up and it's dancing. The birds pass by and they're dancing. And it takes the pressure out of me, and I'm the one that has to function in the world and manage the world. It's much more that we're watching things like a child who is watching a kaleidoscope, and the colors are changing all the time, and we're watching a kaleidoscope. That's our practice. It's much more like that than like someone, a cat, trying to catch a mouse. I've got to catch a thought. It's not good. I must fix this thought, and I must fix that thing, and this disturbing me, and that disturbing me. I got rid of that, and I got to fix this. It's much more like the child looking at the world through a kaleidoscope of things dancing, and then nothing really is disturbing. It's all dancing. So a thought really is just a thought. So a thought actually doesn't disturb us. It's we that disturb our thought. It's the self in there that makes something out of thought. So the self, I am disturbing my thoughts. The thoughts are not disturbing me. It doesn't matter what they say. It's me that's disturbing the thought. So we drop down from filtering things, from processing things, from choosing this, from not wanting this to happen and not that, from trying to control life, from trying to... and moving into a dynamic place where there's just being, dancing. I think he said it, no, he didn't talk about that. Yes, he did. At the still point, there is the dance. T.S. Eliot said it. The dance is in the still point. So it's not dead place, it's full of life. But the duality of me trying to fix life actually contracts things, doesn't allow the dance. But in the dance is stillness. There's a nice story, which is a long story. It's one of the most beautiful stories, to my mind, in the text. I'm not going to go into the whole story, but anyone that's really interested can catch me later and I'll tell the story. But it's a story of Angulimala. That I like is Angulimala was Shoded Drachim, or Yar. He was a robber and he murdered everybody that came into the forest. And he killed 999 people. And the Buddha was nearby, and the Buddha said, to kill so many people is huge suffering, I have to help him. And the monk said, don't, he'll kill you. He's nobody, he kills everybody. The Buddha said, don't worry, I'm going alone. I don't want anyone to come with me. And he walked, and Angulimala chased him. And he kept walking, and Angulimala chased him, couldn't quite catch him. And Angulimala said to him, stop, 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 stop. And he turned round and said, you stop. I stopped a long time ago. And it's this beautiful image, and enough to confuse Angulimala from his trap in his mind, enough to confuse him, because he asked the Buddha, what do you mean, you stopped and I should stop? And the Buddha said, you just kept going, you've been killing, you've been doing harm, you've been hurting. I stopped in the middle of my life. You stop. So it doesn't mean we have to shut down anything. The dance is going on all the time. In the still point, there is the dance. So it's in the middle of our being, it's in the middle of our bodily life, it's in the middle of the breathing, it's in the middle of the moving, it's in the middle of the thinking, there is the still point. And it just needs us to reduce the amount of resistance and to see it. So I want to finish with a quote from Krishnamurti. I've just got interested again in Krishnamurti because somebody, Noah, wants to set up a Krishnamurti retreat here in December with someone from India at the Rajghat Center, where I spent a year just outside Varanasi. It's a school and a center, Krishnamurti Center, and I was there teaching in the school for a year in Varanasi in India. And she raised my interest again in Krishnamurti, so I started to read a little bit of, and the things I like about Krishnamurti are his descriptions of his own way of seeing, which show this stillness inside seeing the world, not cut off at all. So I would like to read you a quote that how he describes this process as he sees the world. And by the way, in this, he doesn't say me, he says you. So I'm going to change every time he says the word you, he means me, myself, and I'm going to change it back to me, because otherwise it doesn't really make sense. That morning, the sea was like a lake, or an enormous river, without a ripple, and so calm that you could see the reflections of the stars so early in the morning. The dawn had not yet come, so the stars and the reflection of the cliff and the distant lights of the town were there on the water. And as the sun came up over the horizon in a cloudless sky, it made a golden path. And it was extraordinary to see that light of California filling the earth and every leaf and blade of grass. As I watched, a great stillness came into me. The brain itself became very quiet, without any reaction, without a movement. And it was strange to feel this immense stillness. Feel isn't the word. The quality of that silence, that stillness, is not felt by the brain. It is beyond the brain. The brain can conceive, can think, or make a design for the future. But this stillness is beyond its range, beyond all imagination, beyond all desire. I am so still that my body becomes completely part of the earth, part of everything that is still. And as the slight breeze came from the hills, stirring the leaves, this stillness, this extraordinary quality of silence, was not disturbed. And as I watched the sea, so very still, I really became part of everything. I was everything. I was the light and the beauty of love. Again, to say I was part of everything is also wrong. The word I is not adequate because I really wasn't there. I didn't exist. There was only that stillness, the beauty, and the extraordinary sense of love. So let's take a couple of quiet minutes together.